This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Our guest this afternoon is journalist Peter Goslin. He's the national economics correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Covering his beat, he's learned that while the chances we may suffer a financial calamity have decreased over the last couple of decades, the consequences of a serious setback are greater. We're likely to fall faster and harder with little to cushion our landing. Goslin says Americans from the working poor to the reasonably rich are affected. Why is this so? That's the question the reporter takes up in his book, High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families. The book is based on a series of articles he wrote over the last several years for the Los Angeles Times. In a nutshell, here's what Goslin sees. He sums it up like this in the introduction to High Wire. The basic social contract on which American society has always rested, no matter how imperfectly, has begun to change. The inherent balancing of competing interests that lay at the heart of the bargain has been upset. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion with your questions and comments. We look forward to your phone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. As I mentioned, Peter Goslin is the national economics correspondent for the LA Times and a member of the paper's Washington Bureau. Twice a recipient of the George Polk Award, he is currently a visiting fellow at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. His book, High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families, is published by Basic Books. And again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Peter Goslin, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's an honor to be with you.
In order to illustrate how the social contract has changed, maybe you would share with us the story of two generations of the Koss family.
Sure. I started out with the Koss family because it seemed to me their experiences and also their incomes illustrate the change that I think has occurred. Richard Koss Sr. and his wife never made in constant dollars and, you know, modern dollars more than $60,000 or $70,000 a year. Koss Sr. worked essentially all of his career at Mack Truck, a Mack Truck plant in Pennsylvania, and he put three boys through college, including his son and namesake Rick Koss Jr., who did the American Dream thing, went to college and went on to Duke and got an MBA and went into the fast-paced industry of financial services. Unfortunately, the senior Koss's income, and they shared a lot of their financial documents with me, basically is a steady, modest but steady rise over the entire course of his work life. He and his wife are now retired. The junior Koss's experience and income looks very, very different. Rick Koss went into banking, worked for Mellon Bank during the late 70s and early 80s. Mellon is a huge banking institution and had not had a layoff in 118 years until it got to the mid-80s, made too many loans into the oil patch, ran into huge problems, and laid off a lot of people, including Rick Koss. He got another job at another bank and did very well until the 90s real estate crunch, early 90s real estate crunch, and he was laid off again. And this continued to happen until most recently he was working at PNC, another large banking institution in Pennsylvania and in the country, and was again laid off. And his family's income looks like he was having a heart attack. It bounces all over the place. And my argument in the book is that's a good measure of the kind of dangers that families are facing on their own right now that a previous generation did not face.
Yeah, at some point in the book, there's a chart where you chart when something happens that's a big shock. The probability of your family's income falling 50% or more has gone way up.
That's right. Plus, the simple fact of the matter is that we've done a lot of talking about the social contract in America changing, but the truth is that economists can't measure it, so they don't really take that talk all that seriously, and a lot of policymakers don't either. So part of what I'm trying to do in this book is talk to American families about why they feel insecure and to show them that there turn out to have been really good reasons to feel insecure even before we got to the current economic mess. But the other thing I'm trying to do is say, look, I can give you quantitative measures that the world is substantially different. So one of the exercises I did was the following. I looked at a nationally representative sample of families. It's called the Panel Study of Income Dynamics. It's supported by the National Science Foundation mostly, and the keeper of the records is the University of Michigan. And it's a nationally representative sample of 5,000 families and their spinoffs, and we've kept records on them for 40 years. So I can watch people move through time. And I simply asked, of families, working families, who experience one of a panel of income-threatening events, and these are the sort of things that happen to people in the course of a work life: a spell of unemployment, a job-stopping illness, a disability, a divorce or separation. And I looked at what fraction of the people who were hit with one of these events suffered, and I took this as a complete seat of the pants measure. I wanted it to be a big enough hit that you and I would both agree we really wouldn't want to have that happen to us. And so I just picked 50%, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the fraction of people who were hit with, who experienced one of these income-threatening events, who then went on in the year after that event to experience a 50% drop in their income. And what I found is that with each of these events, that the fraction of the size of the group that experienced these 50% drops afterwards has grown in the case of every one of these income threatening events. And my argument is that it just shows you that in fact things that we experience and that our parents before us experienced, economic events that are important to the material lives of our families, are more dangerous now.
Mm-hmm. But now, the people who are in the business of risk management, what do they have to say about our chances of being clobbered with a significant economic setback?
Well, what my own figures show is that the frequency of many of these events mm-hmm. has gone down. Take unemployment. We know today that even in this current economic mess we're in, that the average unemployment rate is lower at any point in the business cycle than it used to be. So that means your chance of getting knocked off the horse is less. But what I'm saying in these figures is that woe be to you if you do get knocked off.
Mm-hmm.
And when you measure risk, it isn't just how often a bad thing happens to you. It's how bad it can get if it does happen to you. It's the combination of things. And the argument in the book is that while we've been looking at the unemployment rate, this big number that comes out every month is going to come out tomorrow morning for June, and will probably go up. We've been looking at that and saying, well, look, things are getting better. Something else has been happening, which is that the nature of unemployment has changed, and it's become more dangerous to those who get hit by it.
It also seems to me that even if we are employed and we're in pretty good shape, and thank God no bullets have headed our way yet, we're losing ground.
I think in many ways we are. One of the things – look, the standard story about most of the last generation, again, before we got into the current economic mess, is that this was a period of near unparalleled prosperity. And I don't for a minute want to deny that millions upon millions of Americans did well during much of the last 25 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. Houses on average are bigger. Families on average have more cars, et cetera, et cetera. But the problem is that the safety nets that keep us economically stable have been eroded or reeled in altogether and pulled away from us. And so that if you do, the biggest set of safety nets for most working Americans, the vast majority of working Americans, are their employer-provided benefits. And one of the things I discuss in the book is that your grip on those benefits and your recourse if you don't get benefits when you need them. And here I'm talking about health insurance or disability coverage or 401k, all the things you get through your employers. That's the real safety net for working age Americans. It's not Social Security. It's not Medicare. That's for people who are retired. It's these employer-provided benefits. Your grip on them and your remedy if you don't get coverage by them has been substantially eroded over the last generation because of a series of Supreme Court and Federal Appeals Court cases that most of us never noticed, but it has really changed the rules of the game on employer-provided benefits.
Yeah, you did a good bit of reporting on ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, and how it was meant to protect workers, but you report it's been hijacked.
I think that's so, and one of the bars I set myself was not just to get people who, are advocates for the poor, or advocates for working class Americans, but people very much in the free market mold to assess what they think has happened to ERISA. Now, one of the things I think is true is that most Americans don't understand that their benefits are really governed by their grip on them are really governed by one federal law, not state law, not any longer really, in most cases, union contracts, just the federal benefits law, which is called ERISA. And ERISA was passed in 1974, and its congressional authors intended it to be a protection for employee benefits. And we know that because it said they put it right in the preamble of the law. It says it's to protect employee benefits. But over the last 20, 25 years, there have been a series of court decisions that have basically all tilted in favor of employers, insurers, and benefit administrators, to the point that the law really has been flipped on its head. And I quote a number of judges who are Reagan-appointed judges who've had to handle these cases and are simply outraged by what has happened to the law.
And are you still there?
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm sorry. Okay. I ended that a little abruptly, didn't I? I apologize. Yeah.
Well, occasionally, sometimes something goes wacky with the phones, and we have to.
I apologize.
It's okay. No. It's fine. When you wrapped up there with the judges who were voicing their frustration and their outrage, there was also a fellow that you quoted saying, you know, what we really need to do is really look at the fine print. Because we're all too comfortable about what we think we have.
That's right. I think that people don't understand the really substantial limits in lots of different areas. In effect, I argue that. We made a decision at the end of the 70s when the country really was in a lot of trouble economically that the way out was to make our markets much freer. And I think most Americans think that in the fullness of time that was probably a good idea and that we made some moderate changes and we got ourselves back on track. Mm-hmm. And what I see as having happened is that free market makeover of America has kept right on chugging behind the scenes and changing the way the material underpinnings for American families. It's happened in benefits. It's happened in such bought and paid for things as your insurance policy, where insurers, for example, your homeowner's policy, the most popular kind of homeowners policy that existed in the 80s and by the early 90s in most of the country, basically put it on the insurer to make sure that they priced it right and that the coverage was sufficient. And the promise was, if your house burns down or is hit by a twister, they'd replace it. End of story. What's happened over the last 20 years is that insurers have moved away from that and changed your policy over to a very different kind of policy where they pay you up to a fixed dollar amount and then typically 10 or 20% more. But you've got to pick the dollar amount. You've got to keep up with all these changes, the building code changes, the change in the price of plywood, what the plumber gets in your neighborhood if he's building a house or a carpenter. It's really left to you. And the chance of you noticing that this change was made, I mean, I tell the story of some families. Unfortunately, California is like a laboratory for this because California is plagued by wildfires, and as it is right as they are burning right now. So what happens is that whole neighborhoods get burnt down. And then you can see when you watch what happens to people, that it's not just one person who is underinsured, it's the entire neighborhood. When you go and pursue those cases, when you try to figure out what went wrong, you discover that these changes, these fundamental changes in policy, were made with the most confusing notice to homeowners. So it's no wonder they didn't know the fine print was so fine and so confusing that even people trained in the area could overlook it.
Yeah. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine is Peter Goslin. He's a journalist. He's the author of High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families. The book is based on a series of articles he wrote over the last several years for the Los Angeles Times. He is the national economics correspondent for the Times. He's currently a visiting fellow at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's go to the phones now and take a call from a listener in Champaign. Line one, hi.
Thank you. A couple of things. About a dozen years ago, after 16 years of employment, particular business I'd been working for, they had to close the doors, went out of business. And I was really shocked at how little money I got for unemployment for the period that I was unemployed. I mean, after they took taxes out, it wasn't enough to live on. In fact, it wasn't really enough to live on before they took taxes out. If I hadn't had some savings, I would have been in real trouble. And I don't know what the experience for most people are, but I don't think that, they have any idea how tough it is for people who have to draw unemployment.
Your caller raises a really important point, and this is an example of a change that people probably just didn't notice. I mean, unemployment in this country, unemployment compensation has never been generous in most states. But among other things, it was until the late 70s, early 80s, tax-free. But one of the things that happened in the early 80s is that we began to tax unemployment benefits, and that reduced them still further. The other thing that has happened is that our unemployment compensation system came out of the New Deal, and it was designed to cope with short stints of unemployment, mostly of industrial workers. The notion was that this was a tide me over for somebody while the plant was on shutdown during either a slack period or for retooling. So not only are unemployment benefits tax now, but they really don't last very long. Unfortunately, the nature of employment, the nature of unemployment has changed over the last 70 years, and a much larger fraction of those who do get unemployed are unemployed for an extended period of time. The way the government keeps its records, it basically stops keeping its records after sort of 6 months in most cases. But the fraction of people unemployed 6 months or more has gone up a lot, so that we have a system that doesn't pay very generous benefits to begin with, that we now tax, and that it only pays benefits unless the government passes, you know, special extended unemployment benefits, doesn't pay benefits beyond 6 months, even though the fraction of people who are out more than 6 months has grown substantially over the years.
Does the listener want to follow up?
Yeah. Another thing that I've noticed is that our disparity in not just income but wealth in this country seems to be approaching what it was like during the robber baron period of the late 19th century, and also just before the crash in 1929. And I'm just wondering if we aren't in a very precarious situation today for more than just, you know, individuals here and there, but for the economy as a whole. I realize there are mechanisms in place that weren't in place then, but we seem to have stretched all our institutions to the limit, and it also seems that, you know, with the collapse in the financial markets and banks and things, that they've done a pretty good job of papering things over and making it not seem as bad as it is. But I'm just wondering, you know, if we are in a situation that, you know, we were in some 90 years ago or so.
Okay.
Well, let me say two responses to that. One is that I do think that we are in a really strikingly precarious time right now. The set of problems that have emerged over the last year are not the run-of-the-mill problems that the economy cycles into and cycles back out of on a regular basis. Besides the fact that we almost certainly will eventually be told that we are in a recession now, the financial system is really posing a series of very complicated sort of self-reinforcing problems to regulators and to the government, to the Federal Reserve. And I think increasingly you're seeing people who follow the economy say this is not going to go away quickly. And one of the things that I think I've realized in writing the book is that people are regular working Americans are arrived at the doorstep of this current crisis really uniquely ill prepared to deal with it, because even though they'd gone through a long period of prosperity, they'd also been nudged out onto the economic limb farther and farther, and so that now that bad times are upon us, they are not well prepared or many of them are not well prepared. Let me just say one other thing, which is that one of the things I made a decision about in the book is there is no doubt that income inequality has increased substantially in this country, and there's no doubt that it has the capacity to really make people mad, particularly when they read about executives who walk off with, you know, huge pay packages when their companies or the financial markets are left in tatters. But one of the things that is the reason I wrote the book the way I did is, and that is that I don't focus a great deal on income inequality. I try to focus a great deal on income and economic security, is because I have been amazed doing interviews with people how willing how little people are upset about the widening gulf between the rich and the poor, just so long as they are sure that they and their families are on the right side of the divide. So I try to write to people about their economic circumstances, where they are, rather than ask them to think about sort of the other guy, whether the other guy is Bill Gates or think about the robber barons. What I'm telling them is that they, in their situations, even if they prospered in the recent period, are more precariously financially perched than they were a generation ago.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Let's go next to someone in Decatur on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. A very, very, very timely program. Just a couple of quick observations and comments, and I'll offer them up and listen offline. I think a lot of what you're talking about is terrifying, and I think a lot of it hinges on loyalty, or maybe the lack thereof, of companies to employees. I grew up in the 50s and 60s. My dad worked for a company. We weren't rich by any means, but being laid off, being unemployed, never really factored into our situation, lucky enough, and we had peace of mind, or my dad had peace of mind. I think that seems to be gone by the wayside, where if you have a job, great, but who knows, you know, maybe by tomorrow you won't. I work for a healthcare company. It was started privately owned, bought by a $4 billion a year company, and the kiss of death was, as soon as they took over, well, don't have to worry, nothing's going to change. Well, they cut our benefits, cut our vacation time, and if you didn't like it, well, you know what, there's the door. And they actually fired my boss, as it turned out, for no good reason, and actually fought her on her workman's compensation. And this is a company where the top guy makes $19 million a year. So I think there's the loyalty and the peace of mind, unfortunately, for my generation, is the thing of the past, and that's terrifying. But the other observation I wanted to make was there was a transference of wealth. What I'm concerned about is my kids, the World War II generation transferring all these millions of dollars, and that's just not going to happen. People in my bracket, that's just not going to happen for our kids, and I'm terrified as what we're leaving our children. And then the other observation is the global economy. And woe to us if everyone in China and India gets a car and a microwave and a stove. I think that kind of growth on a global scale will be unsustainable, and I think we'll be paying the price for it. And I'll go ahead and listen offline. Thanks.
Okay, that's a big list.
All right. Well, let me start down it. Let me just start with employment. I mean, one of the things I write about in the book is about job tenure, and that's essentially what the Decatur caller is talking about, that people stuck with companies and companies stuck with their people in the past, and that there's less of that now. Some of the figures I offer in the book, I look at prime working age men. And the reason I pick men is because during the period I've looked at, the 30 years I've looked at, 25, 30 years I've looked at, women were still pouring into the full-time, full-year labor force. So it's hard to do apples-to-apples comparisons with women. So if you just look at men who've played the same economic role through this whole period, right, you look at prime working age men, sort of 45 to 54. These are people who they'd better be settled in their job because among other things, that their job prospects for going in different directions are narrowing as they get older. This group is the group that most likely has families and obligations like houses and so on and so forth. So the average job tenure of this group 25 years ago was 13 years. Today it's 8. And if you look at the next oldest group, the 55 to 64 year old, the drop is even greater. Now, economists will say, well, there are a lot of things contributing to that. They'll say, you know, for example, there's been a huge immigration into this country. And they'll say, of course, immigrants being here a shorter time have shorter job tenure. But the truth is, when you tease all that out, you still get a substantial drop in tenure. Now, we used to be told, Bill Clinton, for example, told a really happy story. He said, you guys have got to get a grip. We're going to have to change jobs a lot more. But implicit in his story was that there would be a good job to land when you had to, you know, you switch jobs. And what we're finding, and what I said about unemployment, is that there aren't always good jobs when you switch from one job to another, and you end up stuck out a longer time than you used to be. So on the issue of loyalty to employers, to employees by employers, I think there's good evidence that there's a lot less of it today, and there's good evidence, measurable evidence of it. On the transfer of wealth, wealth is an amazingly hard thing to look at in America. We really only have some statistics that the Fed develops, I think that you're right. But I don't have a grip on how much smaller the pot is going to be that the boomer generation will transfer to its children than the greatest generation transferred to the boomers. On the global economy, I'd just say that the truth is that we are discovering, when we talked about the global economy first, and when it was really became part of the public discussion, was in the 70s and 80s as Japan was beating our major industries. By the early 90s, there had been formulated a positive story about how America was going to cope in the global economy, and President Clinton had an amazing ability to convey this story. And boiled down, it came down to this: that don't worry, just get yourself educated, and we'll keep all the brain jobs, and the brawn jobs will go abroad. I'm simplifying, but that's basically what the story was. The problem is that what we're discovering is that with cheap telecommunications, and with the fact that other countries besides our own have really world-class university systems, that the brain jobs aren't sticking here, or not all the, you know, I mean, they're not just here. And that means that not only are steel workers and blue-collar workers generally under global competitive pressure, but that pressure goes all the way up the education ranks and way up the income ranks.
Let's take another call. A listener now in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. It's my understanding with the unemployment rate that that's not realistic, because my understanding is if you're off so long and you're not getting unemployment compensation, it's not really in it. So it could actually, if it's listed as 5%, it could actually be 7 or 8%. Is that correct or not?
That's right. In fairness to the people who bring us the unemployment rate, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they offer various alternative measures that include long-term unemployed or discouraged workers who basically – what makes you count as unemployed is you have to have had a job, and you have to be looking for a job, or you have to be looking for a job. And you have to have a job or be looking for a job. And the fraction is the basically the people who don't have a job but are looking for a job over the total of people who have jobs and who don't have them but are looking. And but of course there's that whole group of people who have just plain stopped looking because of they become discouraged workers. There are also a lot of other people who the government simply doesn't do a very good job picking up. Part-time workers, the contingent workers, and so that it's much what's going on in the labor market is much more complicated than what's boiled down in the unemployment, in the official unemployment rate.
Yeah.
We also have a case of, the underemployed. When I go to Walmart, you know, which I don't try to go too often, but, you talk to people out there and ends up that they had a job and, they're still waiting. You were talking about globalization. I can remember, the Wall Street and, when it was being sold and certain members of Congress, how great it is. Oh, yes, Wall Street said, some people are going to have to lose their job. Just like the fact that these aren't people, and they sit there, especially in Congress, with a wonderful health care program. They can go anywhere they want, and they got a great retirement program. So, you talk about inequities, they certainly are there. Finally, I like the title High Wire because it really best illustrates, what you're talking about today. What about the family that you looked at? If you took his income, the father, and he put his kids through school, and then charted it, and then you compared the ups and downs, in some ways, some of the children were doing way less, right? Is that sort of the message?
Well, what I try to do, because as I say in economics, all good arguments have to come with numbers. So I give you numbers. You don't have to read the third chapter. That's my numbers chapter. I think I make my case without the numbers, but I wanted to give you a measure, if you wanted to have it, of the dimensions of this change. So it turns out that in the stock market, the way you measure risk of a stock is called the beta of a stock, and it's how much the price of a stock bounces up and down relative to some mean like the whole market, the Standard & Poor's 500 index. And the basic idea behind this measure of a risk is that the more a stock bounces up and down, the more likely it is that an investor will get caught out with the price way down when he or she wants to sell. Well, so I looked at family income, and instead of asking, are you poor or are you middle class or are you rich, as if it's a static picture, I simply said, for a given family, how did they get from where they were in 1990 to where they were in 1999, or where they were in 1995 and where they were in 2005? And in other words, if their overall income went up, did it go up in nice, easy increments, orderly upward steps, or did it fly through the ceiling and fall through the floor? And it turns out that flying through the ceiling and falling through the floor, the wobble of income, has increased for all sorts of families, not just for poor families, not just for families in the middle, but for families way up the income spectrum. The instability of income has grown. And the argument I make in the book is just like volatility or instability is a measure of risk in the stock market, it's a measure of risk in the family. And what that riskometer for American families show is that families up and down a huge swath of the income spectrum are carrying a lot more risk than they used to. It doesn't mean they're going to get nailed by one of these events. It just means that they could get nailed, and they're going to be more damaged if they are.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Our guest this afternoon, Peter Goslin, author of High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families. Let's continue to talk with some other listeners. Next, we go to a listener in Indiana on line 3. Hi.
Hello. A couple of things. I think those of us who went through school in the 50s and then college in the 60s are now learning what capitalism really means, and what we were taught in college and stuff was certainly a biased situation in terms of the United States. We're finding it out in terms of the oil. I meet regularly with my classmates. I get to hear a lot of different stories of problems people have, and it seems to be the main thing that contributes to a lot of this is the medical people not having national insurance of some form, whatever. You can go into a hospital emergency room and end up at a major hospital and have $27,000 you owe somebody. And a lot of people in retirement, they don't even make that kind of money, drawing it from the government, so there's no way in hell they can pay it off. And then there's the lien on the credit card, and that gets you in a corner because you think that possibility you'll get it all together and be able to pay them off. And then the other thing is the volatility with factories. I live in a town here in north central Indiana. It's about 30 miles from Purdue University. It's just been decimated over the last 10 years of 8 plants closing very close together. and there's no way for those people to recover. And, of course, the rest of their lives are going to owe somebody something, and their credit history is sort of bad, so they can't do anything that way. And the other thing is it may be a time for the economists to change some of their definitions, like what a recession means now is similar to what the law was passed 7 years ago during the Roosevelt period. There haven't been any, you know, fine-tunings of any substantial amount that could take care of this situation. Could have been taken care of. There's countries in Europe that do these kinds of things all the time without the decimation that you get like you're getting here in this country. Thanks a lot for a nice program.
Okay. You want to respond?
Well, a couple things. I absolutely agree with the Indiana listener about medical care. When we say, oh, the price of health care is going up, we say, most people think, well, you know, okay, we have to pay a little more, but it's better health care and so on and so forth. But the price is so substantial, and the difference between what you can pay in 1 year and what you pay in the next is so huge, or can be so huge, that there really aren't things that you can handle on your own. The current President Bush, proposed as part of his ownership society agenda that we create health savings accounts. In fact, they exist. They're not widely used yet, but one could imagine them being the next vista in the trends that I'm talking about. But they are basically premised on the notion that you can stash away enough money to basically handle most of your own medical expenses. The problem is that as treatments and have become more expensive, drastically more expensive, the swing, but from 1 year to the next, it can be from a few $100 to a few $100,000. And unfortunately, I know of what I speak here because my wife is ill, and we went from spending about $1,000 a year to having spent on her behalf. We do have very good health insurance, and we're thank the Lord we do. Just on the drugs alone, this year will be spent $300,000. Mm-hmm. Now, that is simply not something that even affluent Americans look. Bill Gates can save for that, right? I mean, he can self-insure. The rest of us can't. I mean, it's too big a hit. Just one other comment on what the listener said. The issue of credit cards. A lot of the talk about credit cards has basically blamed borrowers for having overused cards. And I don't for a minute want to contend that there weren't people who basically took every credit card solicitation that came in the door and went and used them. There are certainly people who have abused credit cards. But I would argue that part of the deal that was struck over the last generation, part of the new social contract, to the extent it's a social contract, that was advanced over the last generation, is that we should use credit. That's a good thing, and that it allows us to create, if you will, our own private safety net, so that we can borrow to fix the roof. We can borrow our way through bad times. The problem is that the bad times can be of such a great dimension that if we were actually to try to fund it ourselves, either through savings or through borrowing, we'd always be in debt. And now that we've hit these bad times, we are finding people who are in terrible straits because they did do the borrowing that was, you know, they were encouraged to do, and now that they're being closed off from sources of keeping it funded, like, for example, putting it against their house. Mm-hmm. So I have great sympathy with what the borrower says.
Yeah. We have
what the caller says.
We have to wrap up here. Before we go, though, I want to have a couple of thoughts from you in terms of this campaign that we're in. Are the presumptive nominees for president addressing these issues?
Celeste, that's a really interesting question. I'm actually scrambling to write a story for this weekend on a piece of that puzzle. I am surprised that the candidates, neither of the presumptive nominees, have addressed this issue head on. They have certainly talked about economics, but they've talked about them, both Senator McCain and Senator Obama have talked about them as a series of discrete policy proposals. McCain talking about free trade yesterday, Obama talking about some infrastructure spending and so on and so forth, but without any broader account of what the aim is. Either one of two things is true. Either the candidates don't get it, that Americans need a new account of how we're going to get from here to there, to the future, in a way that most of us do reasonably well. Or the other explanation I have is they simply are walking into a government that they know has such humongous deficits, with an economy that is in mm-hmm. such trouble, that they're not going to, they feel like they don't have much maneuvering room.
There we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Peter, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
I very much appreciate you having me on.
Peter Gosselin is the author of High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families. His name is spelled G-O-S-S-E-L-I-N. The book High Wire, published by Basic Books.